as a general rule of thumb, we're going to use NIV for the Old Testament and ESV for the New Testament, and just explain why. The ESV is like a word-for-word translation and will be often deliberately vague because the text is vague. I found that reading several Old Testament books like Ezekiel, Numbers, that the ESV was almost unreadable because it was so vague that every sentence I'm like, okay, what could this mean? My brain was working overtime just to work out what was probably being intended, even just for simple setup sentences. And so I found that I basically couldn't read it devotionally because my brain was just working out, like, what is this saying? Rather than, oh yeah, this is a story, I'm totally taking this in. So because we want people to be able to read the Bible for themselves, I think NIV might be, for our current generation, a better translation. But even I found it difficult, I think, to read Ezekiel and Numbers. But there are some books in the Old Testament that the ESV is significantly better for, so we'll use that when necessary. But as a general rule of thumb, NIV. And then the ESV for the New Testament, especially letters, it's probably fair to say letters are the most technical genre. Like, you get sort of clauses, subclauses, justification, clarification, you know, caveats, all that stuff a lot in letters. And sometimes the NIV just makes, I think, overly simplistic choices. So that's why ESV for that. Okay, on the handout I've put the structure of Malachi. We'll do it in 2 weeks. The first week on the header, chapters 1 and 2, God complains about Israel's lack of honour. As a nation, as a whole, they do not honour God. And I've put on the handout, most of you guys do not honour me. I'll justify the most bit. That's the bit that's least obvious later. So first half, guys, I'm sick of your attitude. Most of you do not honour me. Most of you do not fear me. And then the second half, I will come with a judgment day, a day of judgment, a day of refining, a day of separation, when finally, instead of being mixed up together, it will be very clear who does honour me and who doesn't. The complaint that begins the second section is, what's the point of doing good if God doesn't see it? There's no point in trying to be faithful to God anyway, because the wicked seem to prosper and seem to be blessed anyway. And God's like, oh yeah? You think that's a problem? I'm going to fix that one day through a refining day of judgment. So, a very, very simple two-part structure. Your attitude stinks, and then I'm going to come with the judgment day and sort it out. And then today's passage, the broad structure is going to be verses 2-5, God says, I have loved you, but, and the rest of the passage and the main point of today, why do you not honour me? Where is my respect? Given that I'm so good to you, why are you not respectful? Why are you not good towards me? I love you, why don't you love me back? And the why don't you love me back bit, why don't you honour me, is the main emphasis. So that's where we'll go. So 1 verse 1, a prophecy. The word prophecy just means a word from God. So a prophet is somebody who speaks God's word, just very simply. So a word from God, the word of Yahweh, and as a rule of thumb, every time it says Lord in capitals, that in the Hebrew, that it says Yahweh, like God's personal name. And so I'll just read it as his personal name. The word of Yahweh to Israel through Malachi, or Malachi, the name just means my messenger. It doesn't have to be there's a literal guy called Malachi. It could just be I'm sending a message via my messenger. It doesn't necessarily mean that there was a real guy whose name was Malachi, son of whatever. So that's the title. God's got a message to Israel, 1 verse 1. And then the first part of the message is very short. I have loved you. Just to explain the one bit of formatting, I've put the sort of quoted in an email type formatting where there's a line on the left. I've put that three times in our passage, and I'll put that three times next time as well. That's just to highlight that the way Malachi works is through this thing where God says something and then he hypothesizes on what Israel would retort. So commentators call this disputations, and there are six disputations across Malachi. Some people think it determines a structure. I'm not convinced it does, because you'll see, for example, that I think the one in 2:13 on the other side of the page doesn't actually start a new topic. It's just a way of God dramatizing Israel's rubbish attitude. Part of their attitude is highlighted by, I'm saying this, but you're going to be like, oh, how are you doing that, God? That's part of the tone of the book. So the first disputation, verse 2, Yahweh says, I have loved you, and yet you ask, oh, how have you loved us? But obviously God is saying their attitude back to them. And Yahweh goes, well, here's how I've loved you. You know, in history, Esau and Jacob were brothers, declares Yahweh. Well, nowadays, I have loved Jacob, but the country that Esau became, Edom, I have hated. And look beyond your borders. I have turned Edom, his hill country, into a wasteland. I have left his inheritance, not to people, but to desert jackals, desert animals, wild animals. And Edom is a bad guy. Edom is an enemy of Israel. So Edom literally is a threat to national security. Now, verse 4, God has destroyed Edom, and Edom may say, oh, though we've been crushed by God, we will rebuild the ruins. But this is what Yahweh Almighty says. Oh, they may build, but I will demolish. They will be called by everyone the wicked land, a people always under the wrath, the anger of Yahweh. You guys, Israel, will see it with your own eyes, and you will say, great is Yahweh, great is his work, even beyond our borders, even beyond the borders of Israel. And so a very simple premise, God says to Israel, I have loved you, look beyond your borders, look at how I've treated one of your baddies, one of your enemies. Now, it's probably worth an aside that 1 to 5 often gets taught in conservative evangelical circles as a sermon. And it often ends up being taught as a springboard for predestination. You know, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated, because Paul does pick up on that in Romans. But I just don't think that's what Malachi intended. I think it's a setup for the rest of the two chapters. So I have loved you, but why have you not loved me back? So I think it's quite irresponsible just to teach 1 to 5. I actually felt bad for the preachers I've heard doing this, because I've sat there thinking, ooh, tough gig. Like, what are you going to talk about? Like, how much material really is there in those verses? But I think it's very clear. I have loved you. Look beyond your borders. And then we go into a very sort of God ranting about Israel's attitude. So this is the main point. You do not honor me. Verse 6. A son knows to honor his father. A slave knows to honor his master. Now, if I am a father to you, Israel, where is the honor due to me? If I'm a master, where is the respect due to me, says Yahweh Almighty? That you've no respect. And then in particular, he highlights priests. It is you priests who show contempt for my name. And we will see basically the priests of Israel being criticized for the rest of the two chapters. And a comment on function. Why priests and why not just the people as a whole? I think the way I'm taking it is, if the priests have a stinky attitude towards God, there is basically, as the leaders, there's no chance that the people will have a good attitude either. So he's sort of highlighting the failure of the guys in charge of the country spiritually. Like, they do not care about God. They accept, for example, lame sacrifices. They're saying to the common people later, oh yeah, bring a blind animal, that's fine. They should have higher standards. They should actually be teaching the people, rebuking the people. But they're not. So I think that's how priests function. They're the leaders who set the tone for the whole country. So it is you priests who show contempt for my name. But you ask, oh, how have we shown contempt for your name? And God says, by offering defiled unclean food on my altar. But you ask, oh, how have we defiled you? Here's how, by saying that Yahweh's table is contemptible. I don't think that's literal. I think they're saying through their actions, you may as well be saying that Yahweh's table is contemptible. Through your actions, verse 8, here are the actions. When you offer blind animals for sacrifice, Is that not wrong? The law is very clear. Offer unblemished, perfect, whole animals to God. There's a sort of give God your best kind of attitude required. Oh, but you offer blind animals. Is that not wrong? When you sacrifice lame or diseased animals, is that not wrong? Try offering these to your governor. Would he be pleased with you? Would he accept a lame or diseased animal, says Yahweh Almighty? So I've put, there are two attitude issues that the priests have. The first is they have pretend sacrifices, I've put on the handout. And then second, they've been teaching unfaithfulness in marriage over the page. Let me just justify the heading through pretend sacrifices. My former colleague Rob at CCK called this effortless sacrifice. And a lot of people love that phrase because it does a pretty good job of capturing the attitude here. I'm going to make sacrifices, and sacrifice by definition is costly, but I'm going to make sure it's not costly for me. I'm going to give you the diseased animal, the lame animal, the blind animal instead, God. But effortless, I think it could be better. And the reason I've gone for pretend sacrifices is that it's as if they think that God doesn't see. It's as if God isn't real, he doesn't see, it doesn't matter. So there is an effortlessness to it, but there's also a performative fake, almost BS attitude as well. And that's why I've gone for pretend, because I think it's more sinister. Effortless could sound lazy. Pretend is like very deliberate and fake and performative. And I'm sure we've seen that attitude in some of the most extreme, difficult people we've encountered in church, that it's just so pretend, you're like, come on, everyone can see this is pretend. I'm happy for people to debate the merits of the heading, because all the heading is trying to do is to summarize and capture the mood. Verse 9. Now plead with God to be gracious to us, to be merciful to us. With such offerings from your hands, will he accept you, says Yahweh Almighty? Of course not. We will begin to see more and more God explaining, because of your attitude, this is why I'm not going to bless you. So verse 9, plead with God to be gracious. Plead with God to make your situation better. You're living in misery right now. Nope, God says, I'm not going to make things better for you because of your stinky attitude. Instead, verse 10, oh, I wish that one of you would just shut the temple doors. I wish that you would just not light useless fires on my altar. I am not pleased with you, says Yahweh Almighty, and I will accept no offering from your hands. And we must realize just how serious that is. God gave the law and gave them a temple and said, this is how you relate to me. And God's saying, you're doing the whole thing so badly. Your attitude sinks so much. I wish you just shut the whole thing down. Shut down the temple. Stop the fires. Give up. I'd rather you said nothing at all and did nothing at all than to receive these lame animals. Now, I've put verse 11 separately. The NIV doesn't put it paragraphed differently, but I've put it differently because I wonder if this is a future thing that God promises. It's a little preview of the next section, just in one verse. He says, one day my name will be great among the nations, across the whole world, from where the sun rises in the east to the west. So from east to west, my name will be great among the nations. In every place, people will do good relationship with me. They'll do the right incense and pure offerings will be brought to me because my name will be great among the nations, says Yahweh Almighty. So he's saying there will be a day in the future when across all nations, people will honor me. But back to right now, verse 12, you, Israel, profane my name by effectively saying Yahweh's table is defiled. Yahweh's table is unclean. And its food is contemptible. You say to yourselves, ugh, what a burden to serve God. You sniff at it contemptuously, says Yahweh Almighty. When you bring injured, lame, or diseased animals and offer them as sacrifices, should I accept them from your hands, says Yahweh? Cursed is the cheat, and that's why I put pretend. Cursed is a cheat who has an acceptable male in his flock and vows to give it, and then switches it out and sacrifices a blemished animal to Yahweh. For I am a great king, says Yahweh Almighty, and my name ought to be feared among the nations. So you should honour me, you should fear me, but you do not. Just before we carry on, in that grey box on the first page, I've put 3:16 to 18. And that's the text that I use to explain in our overall structure why I think it's most of you do not honor me. So the situation you can deduce is that overall Israel's attitude stinks. And the reason why the collective matters is that Israel as a whole were under contract with God with the law of Moses. So one thing that we Gentiles have learnt well is that individually you're responsible for your own actions. Individually you're responsible for whether you have faith. Individually you will or will not be saved. There's nothing corporate about salvation anymore in that you do not, you know, you're responsible for you. You're not responsible for somebody else, brackets, unless you lead them astray. But therefore, as Gentiles, one thing we struggle to get our head around is that the law of Moses was a corporate contract. It's just one Israel, and they had to obey the law as a whole. And here what we're seeing is they have not obeyed the law as a whole. Their attitude to God as a whole stinks. But you can clearly see from 3:16 to 18 that there are some who feared God. So those who feared Yahweh talked with each other. Yahweh listened and heard. A scroll of remembrance was written in God's presence concerning those who did fear God, fear Yahweh, and honoured his name. And then verse 18, God says, one day you will see the difference between the righteous and the wicked, i.e. between those who serve God and those who do not. So I suppose it doesn't matter which side of Israel was hearing Malachi. If you were part of the your attitude stinks majority, Malachi is a serious warning, like, wake up, smell the coffee, repent. But if you're part of the minority faithful, Malachi is more saying, don't worry, God does see your faithfulness. He does notice that the majority of God's people are fake and are doing pretend sacrifices. But one day it will be very obvious. It's not obvious now. The faithful don't seem to be in any way distinct or blessed, but one day they will be. So that's just me justifying the most of you, because that most thing wouldn't be obvious just from our text today, but it is obvious from the book as a whole. But I haven't put chapters 3 and 4 on the handout, obviously, so that's why I put the grey box there. Before we turn the page, any clarifications up to this point?
Why wouldn't it function as a warning for the faithful as well, not to become like the unfaithful?
It's also a warning for the faithful to not become like the unfaithful, for sure, yes. Like, watch out against complacency, keep watching your attitude to God. Like, do you still fear him? Yes. Let's go over the page then, chapter 2, verse 1. This is the law of Moses bit. So you priests, this warning is for you. If you don't listen, if you do not resolve to honour my name, to fear me, says Yahweh Almighty, I will send a curse on you and I will curse your blessings. That's Judgment Day. And yes, I have already present cursed world, cursed them, because you've not resolved to honour me. So your current life already sucks because of your attitude. The law of Moses, I've given you what you deserve because of your sinful attitude, but I will also one day curse you even further. Verse 3 might be my favourite verse. Just as a disclaimer, in Hebrew there's no such thing as swear words. There's no taboo words, there's no sort of naughty words. That's one way in which our society now differs from back in the day. So probably the best way to translate this would be, because of you, I will rebuke your descendants and I will smear on your faces the shit from your festival sacrifices and you'll be carried off with it. And I'm deliberately wanting to say, you know, you can feel just how disgusted God is. Oh yeah? I'm going to smear your face with shit. That's how disgusted I am. And you will know that I've sent you this warning so that my covenant with Levi may continue, says Yahweh Almighty. And we'll see what the covenant of Levi was next paragraph. Let me just explain footnote B. All the footnotes here today are just NIV footnotes. Sometimes I'll add my own if there's interpretation issues or translation issues. The literal translation would be, because of you, I will rebuke your seed. Therefore, footnote B, or I will blight your corn. It's actually ambiguous. Seed could mean children. Seed, offspring, it's all the same word. But it could also be like your literal fields. I actually wonder whether fields, I'm 60-40 on this, but given verse 2, I wonder if I'll rebuke your corn, or I will blight your corn, might actually be a better translation. Both work, which is why I'm only 60-40 on it. One of my biases, I suppose, is just Occam's razor. What's the simpler option? Okay. We're now going to see the second way in which the priests suck. So the first one is lame sacrifices, blind, disabled animal sacrifice instead of unblemished. And the second one might be surprising, which is unfaithfulness in marriage. And it's kind of weird. I think it's a surprise to people, and most teachers struggle with this bit in Malachi the most. And you often end up just teaching, like, so, don't cheat on your wives, guys, kind of thing. I think verses 5 to 7 are a premise. Here's how priests should be, and it's very knowledge and teaching and truth-based. But verse 8 onwards, but you have gone wrong. So that's a structure within that point, I think. So 5 to 7. So here's my covenant with Levi, verse 5. My covenant with him, it was a covenant of life and peace, like goodness. I gave them to him, and this called for reverence. He did revere me. He did stand in awe of my name. True instruction was in his mouth. Nothing false was found on his lips. So you can see the focus on instruction, truth. He walked with me in peace and uprightness. He turned many away from sin, as he should have. For the lips of a priest ought to preserve knowledge, because he is a messenger of Yahweh Almighty. People seek instruction from a priest's mouth. So this is how priests ought to be. They ought to be teaching truth, correcting falsehood. Verse 8, but you, current priests, have turned from the way. By your teaching you have caused many to stumble. You have violated this previously set up covenant with Levi, says Yahweh Almighty. So, I have caused you to be despised and humiliated before all the people, because you have not followed my ways, but have instead shown partiality, selectiveness in matters of the law. You've been picking and choosing which bits you want to do, which bits you don't want to do. So verse 9, can you see that what God is saying is, part of your complaint is that when you make sacrifices, it doesn't really feel like I'm present. Yeah, that's because I'm not present. I'm not blessing you with my presence, and that's because your attitude stinks. Basically, because of your sin, I'm not going to come back. I'm not here with you. I'm not blessing you. But it's a cyclical problem, because then Israel think, well, what's the point of doing sacrifices if God's not here, if God doesn't see? And then they start bringing more and more disabled animals. So you can see how it sort of spirals. Verse 9 is an explanation. So you priests are now despised and humiliated before all the people because I'm not here. So the priests have to go through this weird thing of doing the sacrifices even though God's not there. And so the whole thing kind of feels like it kind of sucks. I don't think I've been very clear on that. So any clarification questions that spring from verse 9? Does it make sense to people that there's a present cursing because of their present attitude?
So let's use it when they're despised and humiliated, that's God not being with them, that's how they're humiliated.
I think so, yeah. God says, the reason why your job feels rubbish, you're having to do all of this killing, burning, etc. And yet it feels rubbish because I'm not here, because your attitude stinks.
Did you just say despised? Is that despised by God?
The verb caused you to be despised suggests that God's emphasis is on shame in front of the people. You're doing this thing that you know you should on some level, and yet you know that everyone thinks that you must be a rubbish priest. Compared to between the Exodus and God leaving the temple at the fall of Jerusalem, like, God did live tangibly amongst his people. You did Exodus this year, didn't you? You know, when God's present, it's like lightning, thunder, and the whole people are like, oh! You know, they fall down immediately. Like, there must be something awesome about God's presence being there. And so if you're traveling from, like, North Dan, tribe of Dan, to Jerusalem 3 times a year, and seeing God at the temple, you must have felt some of that sort of awesome, trembling, earthquake, lightning, fire, or at least the potential of all of that. You must have felt it in some way. And now this new generation is like, well, it looks like an empty building because it is an empty building. part of the reason I'm highlighting it in terms of relatability is because we also have the same problem of, it doesn't matter if you're faithful or unfaithful right now, either way it does feel like God isn't present physically, and so does he really see? Is it okay to go through the motions today, for example? And you can see why the people being addressed in Malachi and us today would both feel it might be super easy just to be like, ah, well, he doesn't see anyway, so... So we've got up to the end of 9. 10. Do we not all have one father? The editors can choose to either capitalize or not capitalize words. So words like father, words like spirit, is it Holy Spirit or is it just general sort of mood? These are editorial decisions. And so the editors have been honest and said, it could be, do we all have one God? Or it could be, don't we all come from Abraham? But either way, the overall point is, don't we all come from the same place? Didn't one God create us? So, why do we then profane the covenant of our ancestors by being unfaithful to one another? So basically, didn't God create us one? Didn't God create us united? Why then are we dividing up? Why are we being unfaithful to one another? But the unfaithfulness in particular ends up being unfaithfulness in marriage. So 11, Judah has been unfaithful. A hateful thing has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. Here it is. Judah has desecrated the sanctuary that Yahweh loves by marrying women who worship a foreign god. As for the man who does this, whoever he may be, may Yahweh remove him from the tents of Jacob, even if he comes and performs the act, the fake act of an offering to Yahweh Almighty. One problem with marriage is marrying non-God's people, and you can see why people springboard from that to don't marry a non-Christian. Let's just finish the overall accusation on marriage before we summarize. Here's another disputation in verse 13. Another thing you do, you flood Yahweh's altar with tears. You weep and wail because he no longer looks on you with favor on your offerings. He doesn't accept them with pleasure from your hands. So the whole sacrificial system feels like it doesn't work. And you ask why? So God's like, I see you crying. I see you crying. And you're like, why? Here's why. Because Yahweh is a witness between you and the wife of your youth. You have been unfaithful to her, even though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. Has not the one God made you? You belong to him in body and in spirit. And what does the one God seek? Godly offspring. And footnote E acknowledges that the first half of the verse is a little bit ambiguous in Hebrew. When it says that, generally what will happen is that the Hebrew vocabulary is very, very obscure, and because its usage count is very low, you don't have loads of other texts to understand what that word means. So that's what it will often be if that footnote appears, and it does appear a fair number of times in the Old Testament. Sort of, oh, we're not quite sure. Essentially what they're saying is don't hang your entire life's theology on the first half of that verse, because we actually are not sure we've translated it completely right. But what does God want? He wants godly children who are instructed in the teaching of God, not parents who split up and do whatever the heck they want and disobey my words. So, be on your guard, and do not be unfaithful to the wife of your youth. And then 16, the man who hates and divorces his wife, says Yahweh, the God of Israel, he essentially does violence to the one that he ought to protect, says Yahweh Almighty. So be on your guard, stop being unfaithful, do not be unfaithful. So think, why unfaithfulness in marriage? Why is this a big deal? Because in the Old Testament, the way that the next generation would know God, it's not just priests teach the people, right? So that's the first part. Priests are teaching the people, priests are failing. Why does it matter that priests are not instructing the parents in Israel? Because instead of doing the right thing, which is staying together and teaching the children the word of God, the parents are, through their actions, showing that they can just do whatever they want. They don't care. Or let's be realistic, in this patriarchal society, the dads especially don't care. They're not doing their right job of teaching their children. Instead, they're just doing whatever they want, even marrying women who worship foreign gods. So that has a generational effect. How can the children then fear God if their parents don't fear God? I think that's why the unfaithfulness in marriage is being highlighted. It becomes a tip of the iceberg of a whole nation generationally going further and further away from God in attitude. So I hope the mechanism makes sense. So I wouldn't solely teach 2:5-16. I wouldn't teach as a standalone, which clearly I haven't done today. The problem with doing it as a standalone is that it gets closer to mere ethics. Like, everyone just stare at the couples and be like, oh. So no matter how unhappy they get, they can't get divorced. I don't want to limit it just to that, or just to, if you're single, don't marry a non-Christian, for example. I think it's symptomatic of a mechanism that leads to not trusting God, not fearing God. So that's my walk through the text. Any clarification questions on how the text works? Now is the best time. If you want to challenge the points, for example, now is also a great time. Yeah, Tiffany.
Do you mind explaining again, because I think you have explained a bit, on why chapters 1 and 2 are a text of priests?
Even 3 and 4 isn't everyone. So it actually gets said that God will refine the priesthood, early chapter 3. So actually, if anything, priests seem to be the most addressed subset of Israel. So the question is more, given that in Malachi the priests are the mainly addressed parties, is it possible, for example, let's get the sort of, you know, your lawyer who's like, this doesn't apply to me, lawyer. That guy inside you might be like, well, it doesn't apply to me. It only applies to, say, church leaders. I don't have to worry about Malachi. I get out of jail for free. And I'm saying, no, lawyer, that doesn't work. So I'm suggesting instead the priests have that key instructing the people role. It says that in chapter 2, my covenant with Levi, verses 5-7, right? They're supposed to instruct the people. So I'm saying if he targets the priests and they're fully corrupt, then the people must also be corrupt.
It also is written for Israel as well.
Yes, 1:1, but it's the whole thing is written to Israel, even though in God's delivery he is addressing priests in particular, but he wants the whole of Israel to hear the priests being told off.
Is the original audience for this? Is this a post-exilic book?
Yes. So post-exile, so Judah were in Babylon for 70 years and then came back and tried to rebuild Jerusalem. So they have this rubbish and shoddy version of the temple that in Ezra 6... those older people who remember the older temple just cried. They wept when they saw how bad it was. Haggai 2:3, God says, doesn't it look like nothing? God's own TripAdvisor review of the temple is 0 stars out of 5. Like, rubbish. Looks like nothing. So they're living in this frustrated situation where they're supposed to do the sacrifices, but given God's not there, it's like, oh, why bother?
Clarification, in verse 10 does it switch to...
Which chapter?
2. Does it switch to Malachi, the messenger?
Yes, I think so, yeah. I think the NIV does a good job of acknowledging that by not putting it in single speech marks. So the NIV, you can see most paragraphs. So, for example, the paragraph 2:3, paragraph 2:5, all speech marks, punctuation are entirely editorial. In all original Bible manuscripts, there's no punctuation whatsoever. So you have to sort of deduce it. Basically, the objective is that you can read consecutive verses, the whole passage, for yourself in your own devotional time. That's the objective. So if there's anything in the way of that, this is now the time to address those obstacles. Here's what I suggest we'll do. Normally, on a Sunday, like once we're up and running as ABC, we'll have an hour and a half for exposition, then an hour lunch, and then an hour and a half of members' ministry time where we will talk about how the passage is impacting us and we'll speak the truth in love. Then we'll also like share how life is going and pray for each other. Because we have a bit of time before lunch, we've got about 20-odd minutes, can I suggest we do a very diet version of members' ministry time, that second thing, where we basically talk about how the passage strikes us